Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, October 2nd, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons. Here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, a very fluid situation in our nation's capital where the federal government remains closed while Congress remains locked on a funding bill. We'll talk about the media coverage of this big story. Should pundits on CNN's Crossfire be held to the same ethical standards as the journalists at the news network? I'll ask our panelists about a controversy swirling around Newt Gingrich. The paywall experiment is over at the Dallas Morning News. We'll talk about why the paper's management decided to return to a free-for-all content delivery model. And there's a lot more I hope we'll be able to squeeze in before our time's up. But let's start with what's going on in Washington, D.C. I don't know about you, but Monday night, I stayed up pretty late into the night watching C-SPAN, waiting to see if they'd be able to stop the shutdown of the federal government. At the same time, Jon Stewart opened The Daily Show, placing the blame squarely on House Republicans for their one-sided fight against the Affordable Care Act, which he mockingly called the end of America as we know it for reasons no one is clearly able to explain.
Nobody's saying it's a good law. Nobody's saying it's a bad law. But it's a law. Are you familiar with how the world works? Did you see the Giants game on Sunday? Okay, they lost 31-7. And you know what the Giants didn't say after that game? If you don't give us 25 more points by midnight on Monday, we will shut down the NFL. They didn't say that. What I'm saying is, wouldn't it be nice if the United States Congress aspired to the maturity and problem-solving capacity of football players. Man!
So that clip, you can watch it in its entirety on our links blog. It runs about 7.5 minutes. Goes on to say that he figures Republicans are going to get trashed in the media and shows a montage of headlines. What do you guys think? What's the media's approach been, and has it been fair?
You know, I mean, I think you always are going to see the stories cast in this who's to blame frame. And that gets kind of tiring. In fact, I've gotten tired of watching it as much as I'm a political observer. I will say, though, that some media are covering this story not as a single game, as Jon Stewart described it, but, you know, what's the season? Because I can guarantee you the Republicans and the Democrats and the president are playing for the long game, not the short one.
Well, what I'm finding interesting is now heading into the second day of the shutdown, you're starting to see the news media actually run stories about, okay, how did we get to this point? Yeah. What were some of the reasons behind it? This morning, I happened to be reading the New York Times, and they did an article about how Obamacare and the Republicans' push to stop Obamacare, how it sort of centers in on this on their inability to understand that this is a law that people really need. So, and one of the things that came out, they actually used Missouri in this, and it talked about how, as it turns out, the core Tea Party demographic, working white men between the ages of 45 and 64, would do fairly well under Obamacare. And it says in Missouri, there's 800,000 uninsured Missourians right now. And if now that this law is in effect, a lot of them will be able to get health care to the point where they can afford it. I mean, the lowest amount of health care you can get would only cost you $32 a month. How could people not want that? But we're going to shut down the government because we don't want this to be enacted?
So did stories like that need to be told or need to be looked at a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
Well, I think those stories, I know for a fact that those stories are out there, but now people are starting to read them and go like, okay, because now all of a sudden their attention is on it because the government is shut down and you have all these people who have been basically told to go home. We don't need you to come to work, and we don't know when we're going to have you to come back. So, I mean, now people are going like, well, what is going on here?
I want to see a few more stories about what I think is one of, not the only, but one of the real root causes of all of this. And that is the way that we've allowed redistricting to occur so that basically almost everyone in the House of Representatives, Republicans and Democrats, but especially Republicans got the advantage in the last few years, is in a safe district. They're going into an election, if they survive their primary, which is a problem for Republicans, they're going into an election up plus six, plus 10 or whatever. So it's very hard to lose. And so it's, what have I got to lose? I'm going to be super serving my ideology or my constituents because I can't be thrown out.
Yeah, that's a huge issue. How do you hurt them or hurt the party, in this case, the Republicans, for what they've done? Back in 1994, when we had the last shutdown, the Republicans took a beating when it came to election time. But now with all the gerrymandering in these safe districts, there's very little chance that those who have orchestrated this shutdown are going to be impacted.
I mean, Bill Clinton had something like high 40% in several of those Republican House districts when the government shutdown happened during his watch. Now, Obama has very, very low voter ratings in those districts where the Republicans are located.
Yeah, and the other thing that I'm seeing here is in a lot of the coverage that's going on now is that they're actually talking about how this fight over Obamacare. The reason why you have these arch conservative Republicans that are really, really pushing this, trying to get rid of it, is because once it gets going and if it starts working, you're going to have a lot of people who are going to remember the party
and the that benefit actually enacted it.
So this is a whole New Deal thing, FDR all over again, where you had Democrats who basically won offices because of what they did during the Great Depression. You could have a similar situation here.
Well, for a lot of people, this entire situation has been just one big ball of confusion. The Washington Post has a great item on its Wonk blog that explains the shutdown in detail, how it happened, what's open, what's not, how long the open agencies are likely to stay open, etc. And it's getting passed around the internet as one of the most comprehensive sources of information out there. In fact, we've got a link to it on our blog if you want to check it out for yourself. This is a new pattern we're seeing from the Post. Utility pieces explaining really complicated stories in very simply put terms. About a month ago, it had another item, the 9 questions about Syria you were too embarrassed to ask. That one became one of the most passed stories in the paper's history. This is an interesting shift that we're seeing there, kind of the creation of a new niche for the Post.
Well, I'm going to say that ultimately, I really do like what they're doing, but I also say it comes out of something that's a little less noble. This whole business of listification of the news on the web these days. I mean, I was just looking today, just a couple of news sites on CNN, the best and worst TV finales on the Huffington Post, the 7 top haunted places on the Houston Chronicle's website, 8 companies facing impending doom. So we just love to do these little one-off list kind of things, and people eat them up. What's great about the Post piece, though, is that they use that to draw you into it, but then they spend a lot of time providing a great deal of context and answering questions in ways that the audience can understand. Good for them.
And I think that's the way that if you're going to do this sort of list, that's the way you should be doing it. And one of the other things is that the broadcast media, they're doing this as well. At the end of a piece, they'll say, if you want more information or if you want a more detailed synopsis, go to our website. They were doing that on healthcare, on the run-up to the healthcare law coming into place, the shutdown, they did it on Syria. So the broadcast media has been jumping into this for a while, and now I think print is starting to catch up.
I think it also provides some justification, if we need it, for the fact that we and a lot of other people are teaching journalism students how to write in blog style that's more informal, that injects some humor and voice into it. That can be used to serve a more important mission than just telling a funny story.
And I also think that, you know, if we want the public to be engaged, we're going to have to educate them. And this is one way of doing that. And in our In the way in which people get information now, especially on their smartphones and on their iPads and that sort of thing, this format sort of fits into that.
It's easily digestible.
It's easily digestible. Okay.
Well, CNN got a slap on the wrist on its own network this weekend for its heavily criticized ethics rules and how they're applied, or not, for Newt Gingrich and his fellow Crossfire hosts. The former Speaker of the House and known conservative is also the co-chair of a political action committee that made a donation to Senator Rand Paul, a guest on the very first edition of the show. Last week, CNN's ethics chief admitted Gingrich and other Crossfire cast members are allowed to make financial contributions to politicians, some of whom appear on Crossfire, without disclosing that information to viewers. After all, he said, CNN audiences know about the political leanings or the backgrounds of Gingrich and his other castmates, and therefore there is no need for disclosure. Well, Sunday, Brian Stelter, media reporter for the New York Times, guest-hosted Reliable Sources. He used the weekly media criticism program to criticize CNN.
To be fair, Newt Gingrich is not a reporter. That's true. And Crossfire is not a news show. That's true, too. But it's on a news network, where the standards are high and the employees strive for excellence. So you, the viewer, should know what Gingrich and Stephanie Cutter and Van Jones and S.E. Cupp are up to, just like you should know what Sean Hannity is up to. CNN can do better than this. It can start by debating this very issue of disclosure on Crossfire.
So CNN is taking heat from all over, from the Washington Post, from Media Matters, NPR, the New York Times. Is it warranted? Is it a fair criticism?
I don't know. I'm kind of pessimistic about the whole thing. I mean, it is true what the CNN ethics guy says. Everybody knows the political opinions of the people on that program. Frankly, I wish they hadn't brought Crossfire back in the first. Do we really need another show with pundits opining about things? I don't think so. But is this the most, is this the worst ethical violation that CNN or others are engaged in? I don't know. How about journalists in Washington taking huge speaking fees to talk to private interest groups? That's more concerning to me than having politicians on a GabFest show who are giving money under the table to politicians. I just don't care as much about this one, I guess.
I didn't even know there was an ethics policy when it came to shows like this. I mean, you don't hear this at Fox News or MSNBC. Why would we think that CNN would bring Crossfire back and then all of a sudden throw an ethics policy on top of it? That just makes no sense. I mean, you look at the host of the show and you look at the guests they invite, you clearly are going to expect that, you know, there's going to be some favoritism, some definite connection between these people and the people that they invite on. I just don't get it.
I mean, it is true over on Fox. I'm trying to remember what the example was, but they had had somebody who'd made a contribution, and maybe it was Hannity, and they didn't. They wrote it off as nobody thinks he's a journalist. Keith Olbermann over at MSNBC, when he was giving money to some Democratic congressional candidates and not acknowledging it, MSNBC for a while, what, they suspended him with pay or some such thing, but then he came back on and said, we really have to have rules that apply to today's TV news game. I don't know that I'd be that cynical, but, you know, I just don't know that this is the thing I would spend all my time worrying about if journalism ethics is my concern.
Yeah, and I'm with Mike on this. I mean, there are journalistic lapses every day on cable television. This is a minor one compared to some of the things we saw in terms of them running photos when they hadn't done, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, when they hadn't done good vetting to find out where that photo came from. Those are ethical lapses that I think damages the credibility of journalism more so than Newt Gingrich not disclosing that he gave money to Rand Paul.
Well, since we're talking about full disclosure, I should probably disclose. I advise an organization on campus that is working with Brian Stelter to bring him here to meet with students and speak one evening later this fall at an event we hope will be open to the public. If it does all come together as planned, Stelter will be paid an honorarium for his time. The Dallas Morning News is supposed to be relaunching its website this week, and with the redesign, the paper will be dropping its paywall in favor of an all-access site, free to all web users. It will also offer a premium service to print subscribers with enhanced navigation and limited advertising. Folks who don't want to buy the print edition as subscribers but want in on this new online-only model can subscribe for $2.99 a week. This paywall went up more than 2 years ago. Why choose to drop it now?
In some markets, including Dallas, the paywalls are not working. In other places, they are working, or there's been mixed success. So it just really depends on the market. But I will say one thing, no matter what market you're in, newspapers do not want to call them paywalls anymore. That's just such an ugly word. They like pay models because that suggests that, you know, there can be some modification to it, or it's not a wall that you have to climb over to get all the good stuff. Now, the Dallas Morning News, the only difference, and I've looked at both their free site now, all the content, quote unquote, is supposedly the same if you define by content the words written about a story. But if you go to the site that you now have to pay for, It's $11.96 a month if you want to do that. The only difference really is that it's more visual. I mean, there's lots of pictures on the screen, and it's more tablet looking in its interface. They do say that later they may offer some special content or loyalty points or something. But right now, basically, they're saying pay almost $12 a month more for something that looks nicer on a tablet.
I think the larger issue here is that newspapers in general, when they first moved onto the internet, they gave away the content for free. And now, in the last 2 years, the last several years, a lot of them have gone behind the paywall. Mm-hmm. And people are going, well, wait a minute, I didn't have to pay for this before. Why am I going to pay for it now? I'm not going to do that. And at the same time, that content is shrinking. They're not putting out as much news and information as they were back when before the paywall. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, people just don't feel the need to pay for that, especially when they can get their news and information somewhere else.
And yet there are, I mean, there are other sides to this. The Orange County Register, for example, they have a hard paywall. You pay to get anything from their site. And one of their editors was here a few weeks ago talking about it, and they say it's a huge success, partly because they really super serve all the different communities within their coverage area. They're very engaged with the audience. The content is worth something to people. They'll pay for it.
That's right. The content has to be worth something in order for people to pay for it. And what you're finding is that in places like Orange County, if the content is worth it, they'll pay for it. If not, they won't. And a lot of that is driven by what are you putting out there, both in your hard paper newspaper as well as on your website. And for some of these that are having issues right now, a lot of it is that they just aren't putting out the content that people are willing to pay for.
So speaking of paying or not paying for content online, a record's been broken in online piracy. According to the website Torrent Freak, Sunday night's finale of the AMC drama Breaking Bad was pirated more than 500,000 times in the first 12 hours after first appearing online. The broadcast ratings topped 10 million households, a 440% increase from last season's finale, and Twitter reports 5.5 million interactions on that platform. Mike, you're a big fan. What's the draw?
Now, admittedly, I'm a late fan, but it maybe says something about the success of that show and why it was pirated so much, because a lot of it depended on people coming to it late in the game. Their audiences for that show in the first few seasons were relatively low. It was really a cult following. But because Netflix and iTunes and Amazon Prime came on the scene while it was on the air, suddenly people were able to go back and do their own little marathons and watch the multiple episodes and get caught up, so that by this season, the audience had built to the point where it was setting records. Now, in fact, the producer, the showrunner for the program, Vince Gilligan, who created it, basically said Netflix saved us. There wouldn't have been a season 5 or 6 of Breaking Bad if it hadn't been for this new model for young people, especially, to catch up on our show.
And I think you're going to start seeing this with a lot of other shows. I was gone last week, and when I came back, my wife was like, oh, we got to watch House of Cards. I'm like, where'd you get House of Cards from? Well, I got it in Netflix, and I spent like a whole day watching it. And I'm going like, okay.
Admittedly, I watched it in a weekend.
And I'm saying like, okay, as soon as I get a weekend, I'll watch it. And I just watched one episode with her. And I mean, it is good. It is good drama. And I think that these new models coming out you're going to see more and more of this. Now, the piracy issue, if you're a network or a production house that's putting these things out, I don't know how that's going to play out in the long run if your product is being basically pirated all over the place.
Well, with Breaking Bad, I mean, part of the problem is that Netflix was only putting up the episodes so you could watch them like that for all the seasons up to this one. And then they did the first half of this last year. But any of the last 8 episodes of the show, you could not watch on Netflix. You could only watch it either by going to AMC, where they were running their own marathon with a boatload of commercials in it, or you could download it from iTunes and pay, or you could steal it.
Well, yeah, steal it. Something else that's got everyone talking, a resignation letter delivered to a Taiwanese video producer via YouTube. Only this viral video hits a little close to home for some of us at the journalism school.
Spy had told what's the
That's one of our alumni, Marina Shifrin, dancing in the Next Media Animation offices at 4:30 in the morning, explaining to her bosses why she was leaving. Her job there had been to produce animated satirical video treatments of news stories. In the YouTube post, she said she was tired of writing and producing content just for the clicks. So what's your reaction, gentlemen?
I laughed. I thought it was very unique way to offer up a resignation. And I don't know how it's going to play out later on. I don't know how it's going to help or hinder her career. But just for the moment, she's a rock star when it comes to how to quit a job.
I mean, there was something that was kind of delightfully meta about this whole thing, and that she's talking about all the problems with clickbait and that are problems for journalism. And yet she was doing exactly the same kind of strategy of marketing herself that she was complaining about at the job she was last at.
So let's talk, though, a little bit about maybe if this may follow her or what could be the possible consequences. In the video, she's specifically complaining about long hours, a lack of lunch breaks, and bosses who put pressure on her to produce content that is going to generate page views. Was she being naive about working in a cutthroat industry, or does she have a legitimate beef?
Well, I think she has a legitimate beef, but I also think that this may show, and I'm just saying this may show,
yeah,
that she didn't do due diligence in finding out exactly what this job was going to be and what she was going to be required to do before she went, and making a decision, is this what I want to do in my first job in journalism?
This is her second job in journalism.
Well, then she really should have done some due diligence before doing this, because if you're not happy, then you probably should have left after your first gig and not even taken this.
I mean, I don't know Marina personally, but if you look at some of the things she's written on her blog, for example, I mean, she is a very clever writer. She also sees herself as sort of an aspiring comedian. So maybe she very deliberately thought, I'm going to go to Next Media because they're in Taiwan. They make their money and their clicks off of writing very humorous, strange animation takeoffs on stories in the news. So maybe she found after she went there that she got everything she was going to get out of it, and it's time to move on.
And if she wants to be a comedian, this is a good way to break into it. I mean, by having people download and click on her resignation video, I mean, this is going to be her new career path.
It shows that creativity.
It shows that creativity. Yes, it does.
Comedy. Here's a question, though, Mike, and you brought something up. She wanted to be a comedian and a writer. And this is something that we see with journalism students all the time. There's kind of this misconception that because I've been told that I'm a good writer all my life or all through high school, that journalism is the profession for me. They're not synonymous. And I think that's something people often get confused
by. I'm perfectly okay with that. I mean, I think we tell our students what, you know, the career opportunities are, and there's no one right path for anybody, and lots of people change their minds, and that's perfectly okay. And in fact, in an environment these days where companies are so much less loyal to their employees, you're going to expect folks to jump around from job to job a lot more than at least Ernest and I did when we were, you know, actively in the profession. That's okay. I mean, that's the trade-off. If you're going to treat your employees more like commodities, they can treat you as an employer that way too.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we bring, what's brought into journalism education and what we try to instill in our students, is the ability to write very well in ways in which you can connect with various audiences, but also the critical thinking skills. And that can be adapted to a lot of different jobs, a lot of different career opportunities. And I think that, you know, what she's finding out is that it may not have fit with this, but it may fit somewhere else.
Okay. Well, Shifrin's former bosses have responded, shooting a dance video of their own. You can watch it on our links blog. Spoiler alert, they're hiring. Before we go, I want to talk quickly about a story published yesterday by ProPublica, looking at an internship program required of all journalism students at Northwestern University. During the quarter, students are enrolled in the journalism residency program. They pay their regular tuition to the university, and their host newsrooms pay a $1,200 placement fee to the university. In exchange for the work, students get a stipend for relocation fees, and they get college credit. Now, I should say I managed interns through this residency program for the better part of 10 years when I was working in different newsrooms within Tribune Company. And these students do amazing work, but there is kind of this question of both sides paying the middle.
I think part of the problem in Northwestern is facing is that not only are the students feeling as if they're not getting enough, but when you look at it and you look at this agreement where the actual company is paying Northwestern, then that becomes a little bit dicey in and of itself. And the whole issue of internships and whether or not internships should be paid or unpaid and what students are getting out of it, I think it's getting a lot more scrutiny right now because of the economy, because of the Great Recession, and the fact that once these students get their degrees, they're finding it very difficult to find jobs in their particular field.
I mean, Northwestern kind of has a poor person's version of the college football players not being paid problem, right?
Right.
Universities are making, in the athletic realm, boatloads of money off of these kids, and they're getting nothing except maybe, for a few of them, an opportunity to go pro. Well, Northwestern's only getting a few bucks, you know, after they pay a little bit of a living allowance to these students. But still, it looks bad for them to be receiving cash while the students are not. I have to say, though, that every journalism program, and I suspect in a lot of other areas on campuses across the country, at one level or another, we're complicit as faculty. Maybe, you know, reluctantly so, but we understand that the industry is telling us, well, we really can't afford to pay these interns, but it's a great opportunity to get their foot in the door. And even though federal law doesn't really match that interpretation, we kind of wink and nod and say, we wish you'd pay them. And if you would pay them, it would be better off for everybody involved, but we still let it happen.
And that's one thing that ProPublica is starting to look at very carefully. It looks like this is the first in a series that it's going to be working on, crowdfunding and getting close to $23,000 in pledges to do some in-depth reporting on the economics of the intern experience.
I think it's something that really needs to be looked at. But I also think another component, and I agree with Mike that in a lot of ways, universities are complicit in this. We need to look at what is that experience. Are they, if they're not getting paid, are they at least getting experience that's going to help them in their careers? And if that's not happening, then I think that universities have a responsibility to call out and maybe disassociate themselves from companies that aren't providing that kind of experience for the interns as they go in there.
I think it's a little more difficult for some journalism programs that don't have the same level of professional media, say, as we have,
yeah.
Although even some of our students, say, for example, in photo and in advertising, internships above and beyond the experience we give them are pretty much vital in terms of getting a job.
Though we aren't requiring them.
We're not requiring it like Northwestern.
No, we're not requiring them. But I mean, you know, I think internships are important, but I also think that those internships need to be experiences that the students can use both as they're still in school and once they graduate.
Well, on that note, we're going to prepare to leave you for today. We're out of things to talk about before that music starts playing. Thank you for watching and listening. There's more background for today's topics on our links blog under the talk show tab at kbia.org. You can also replay the show and leave comments for us there, or drop us an email at views@kbia.org. RJI's Travis McMillan directs our show, and Pat Akers handles the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to listen in next week. Mike Ernest and I will have another edition of Views of the News.